mad that when Ansel said they would raise the pay, he said he would double what we're getting currently. So that'll be helpful. The love of history really is truly a labor of love, and my interest in the history of Churches of Christ goes back to my teen years, and one of the names that I often heard referred to was the name of Daniel Sommer. The title of my speech today is Daniel Sommer at 80, but before we get him to 80, I think it's important to at least understand a little bit about the early life of Sommer. His father, John Sommer, was a Hessian, which is a region of Germany, and his mother, Magdalena Wyman, was a Bavarian. His mother was 5'3". His father was 5'5". Daniel Sommer himself, though, stood at least 6'2". May have been 6'3". He was born January the 11th, 1850, in St. Mary's County, Maryland. And very early in life, his father died when he was just a little boy. And so very soon he begins to work. And initially that work was hunting, trapping. He would trap 30 or 40 rabbits in a single day. By the time he was 9 years old, he was able to go to work on a road crew. The minimum age for going to work in those days, incidentally, they had some child labor laws, even in the 1850s. You had to be 10. But his mother knew someone and, you know, slipped him in under the age limit. And so at 9, Sommer goes to work on a road crew. He would walk from between 1 and 6 miles to work every day in his bare feet. I sometimes say, I don't know, in the wintertime that may have been in the snow uphill both ways, but it was quite a challenge for a young man. By the age of 12, he was hired out to work on a farm for $4 a month. And by the age of 13, Sommer's powers of endurance became remarkable. It was said that he could run races with men in cutting and spearing tobacco or anything else all day long. And one of the things that begins to define Daniel Sommer as a human being was incredible physical strength and endurance. And you know, think about what the world's like in 1850. There are no antibiotics. There's no basic dental care. There's none of the basic things that we take for granted every day. In almost every family, 3, 4, or 5 children would die in childhood. And indeed, 4 of Daniel Sommer's brothers and sisters pass away long before Daniel Sommer reaches adulthood. So it was a very, very, very tough world, and one of the things we find about Daniel Sommer is he's a very tough guy from a very early age. It's a hard world that he lives in. It's also a world where he didn't have the best of economic advantages, which meant he didn't have a lot of education. He went to some of the common schools. He wasn't a particularly good student. It's said as he would try to learn something that he would have to sort of struggle a great deal on that learning. And sometimes as a child, when called upon for questions, he would basically be shaking his head. And shaking his head because the knowledge he knew was back there somewhere, and he was trying to bring the knowledge to the front where he would be able to use that knowledge. He was raised as a Lutheran in terms of his religious background. And at age 13, he began attending a Methodist Sunday school. And there he begins to pray and to repent. Sommer, late in life, was asked whether God would hear the prayers of sinners. And Sommer said, absolutely, because I know he heard my prayers when I was praying, even though he didn't know what the truth was. Well, he has sort of this hard life, but eventually he hears a preacher connected with the Restoration Movement. And at the age of 19, he was immersed into Christ by T.A. Crenshaw. That's in August of 1869. He goes to, where do you go if you want to really become a preacher in 1869? He goes to Bethany. And so there he is at Bethany College in Bethany, West Virginia, just 3 years after the death of Alexander Campbell. And so he begins to preach, and he also begins to develop very conservative ideas about what a Christian really ought to be. And he sees a lot of liberalism at Bethany. He sees a lot of pride at Bethany. And interestingly, near the end of his life, in 1939, he writes this in a personal letter. He says, I don't suppose, and he's referencing a man named W.P. Reedy. He says, I don't suppose Brother Reedy has any sinister motive or that he would try to do any harm. Yet I don't think he knows what is meant by being a humble disciple of the Lord Jesus. I fear he overestimates himself and is trying to secure some extra education so as to cause other people to do the same in regard to him. He may be preparing himself for a professorship or even the presidency of the institution known as the George Pepperdine College, which has been lately established in Los Angeles, California. And everything of that kind is so widely separated from the Apostle Paul and from what he required Timothy to be that I confess myself alarmed when I think of it. Alexander Campbell struggled for intellectuality and popularity rather than spirituality and humility. At least that is what I found in Bethany College when I went there 3 years after his death. And you know the results in the so-called Christian church. So one of his very early goals and one of the very early things that defines Daniel Sommer is a deep belief that Christians are supposed to be humble. And that humility is part and parcel with what Christianity is all about. And he sees a conflict between that and what he sees going on in higher education. Now, interestingly enough, at Bethany, although he attended 3 years, he never received a degree. And Sommer made clear later in life he never had any interest in a degree. He wanted to learn the things at the college that he thought would be useful in his preaching the gospel of Jesus Christ. And that was all he was really interested in doing. Now, you sort of think about some of the things Sommer's saying, and one of the things that some of you know about Sommer is he's this tremendous opponent of Christian colleges, especially in the Southland. And he's an opponent who writes with tremendous vigor in that opposition. But one of the key parts of his opposition that sometimes is missed is he's concerned that Christian colleges develop a spirit of pride and arrogance rather than humility. He's worried about that. Some of you might remember, one of the most popular movies of 1939 was The Wizard of Oz. And when the Scarecrow is going to Oz, what does the great and powerful Oz give him for his brains? Gives him a degree. Right? So, this was not really unique to Sommer. I mean, some of this kind of thinking. Well, Sommer himself very soon has a large family. He has 5 sons and 1 daughter that survive to adulthood. He has 2 children that die in infancy, 1 at 1 month old and 1 at 2 months old. A son named Leonard who dies when he's living in Richwood, Ohio, which is not far from the city of Columbus, Ohio. That baby died when Sommer was away in meetings. So, people were talking earlier about the sacrifices that the preachers made and that their families made. And certainly the Sommer family made plenty of them. So he has 2 children that don't survive to adulthood, but these are the children that survive to adulthood. His wife, Catherine, came from a Quaker background. Daniel Sommer, in writing about her late in life, I guess I should add, this is part of a letter that he writes after his wife was dead, perhaps for good reason, says this: I never could reason with your mother. He's writing to one of his children. I never could reason to your mother with your mother. She suffered me to convince her that she should be immersed, but not much else. Yet she did well in many respects and became a great woman. Sommer observed of Catherine Way's parents that they were specimens of stubbornness on the one hand and impulsiveness on the other. Sommer added that Catherine represented both dispositions. And I may say the same of all my children except Frank. Well, this tells you something about Sommer. He's rather blunt, no matter what situation he is addressing. He's dealing with those situations very, very directly. And he never, there's a bit of a conundrum if you think about it. On the one hand, what did he say was the most important quality to have? Humility. On the other hand, you don't often really see humility per se in Sommer. But part of the difficulty is, in most situations, in most rooms of any size, Daniel Sommer is the biggest, toughest, meanest, orneriest, smartest, most intellectual person in the room. right? Kind of like the real McCoy. If it's true, you ain't bragging. And there's some of this tremendous sense of self, and I don't think Sommer himself recognizes how incredibly intimidating that he is to the people around him, including his children. And they needed his intimidating influence much more than they got it, because he's traveling all the time. Sommer became very close, very early in his life, to the great gospel preacher Benjamin Franklin. Benjamin Franklin is not to be confused with Ben Franklin from American history with the kite and the key, but he was probably the leading preacher of the Restoration Movement following the death of Alexander Campbell. And he published a paper called The American Christian Review, and he wrote Sommer a letter. And in the letter to Sommer, the aged Benjamin Franklin said that, "I hope my mantle will fall upon you." And so Sommer took that very seriously. And Sommer eventually purchases the American Christian Review. And he purchased the American Christian Review for $12,000. If we were going to put that in today's money, it's at least $200,000 that he paid for the paper. The reason the paper had that kind of value was because the paper ran secular ads. And one of the very first things that Daniel Sommer does is he ends all secular advertising in the pages of the American Christian Review. And so the very thing that made the paper worth anything, he immediately cuts out. And he cuts them out because he knows that those advertisements for bogus patent medicines are not at all efficacious. They won't cure you of anything. This is Sommer and his wife. This is a photo from about 1890. And this is a photo that shows Sommer once he and his family moved to Indianapolis in 1894, and I'll come back to this in just a moment. So he buys the American Christian Review, he pays $12,000 for it, and he convinces his wife that this is a good deal, and the way he convinces her it's a good deal is he says, "Honey, as it is, I'm traveling all the time. If you let me buy the review, I'll have to stay home and publish the paper." She bought that. That might be why she looked a little hard, because within 6 months he goes back on the road. Well, who's left to publish the review? Catherine Way and the boys. The boys all become expert typesetters in no time flat. But needless to say, Catherine wasn't particularly happy about being left with the review. The paper originally was called the American Christian Review. That was the title when Sommer bought it. But when he acquires the paper, he had been publishing his own paper along with a man named Leonard F. Biddle, and the name of that paper was The Octograph. So they combined The Octograph with The American Christian Review, and they got The Octographic Review, which was mighty confusing, right? If you think about it, that name, Octograph. Well, L.F. Biddle loved the name Octograph. He just thought that was the cat's meow as far as names for a religious journal goes. As far as I know, in the whole history of the world, there's only been one Octograph or Octographic Review. Nobody else likes the name. But it came from the idea that eight men wrote the New Testament. So octo, from, meaning eight, and grapho, from the Greek meaning to write, eight men wrote the New Testament. Well, the paper primarily was circulated in the north amongst farmers. And quite often the conversation would be, "Honey, did the orthograph come yet today? Or anybody seen the Octopus Review?" This caused Thomas R. Burnett to write the following. He said, "The Review Octographic is burdened with a name and with a hefty editor, but gets there just the same. Dan writes like Jeremiah in lamentatious style. Not all the wits and wisdom could make him crack a smile. He thinks the earth is crooked and going to the bad. Good man, but sore afflicted. He needs a liver pad. He's mighty in the scriptures and pretty pat in Greek and knows more in a minute than you'd know in a week. He'd be a benefactor, a blessing to his race, if he would get religion and straighten up his face." Well, Brother Burnett thought that Brother Sommer was a little too much on the serious side, and there was some truth to that. Sommer was a very, very serious person. And while he opposes Christian education, he sort of starts his own answer to it, which were Bible readings. And this is the class of the very first Bible reading in 1894. And there are some very prominent men in this photograph. There's Daniel Sommer. And notice again the people standing or sitting next to him are all dwarfed by him. You know, the only person similar in size is Thad Hudson. And Thad Hudson rather looks like Abraham Lincoln. If you're on this side of the room, this is Thad here on the end. Thad Hudson becomes or tries to become a bit of a poet, published two books of very bad poetry. A lot of preachers have tried to write poetry over the years, and most of it's not of very high quality. On the other side of Daniel Sommer is A.M. Morris. Brother Morris later goes out to Southern California, and he followed the advice that was once given by the Rockefellers and others like J. Paul Getty, which is if you want to get rich, three easy steps. Number one, get up early. Number two, work hard. Number three, strike oil. Brother Morris struck oil on his property in the Long Beach area of Southern California. So this was sort of Sommer's answer to Bible colleges. He thought Bible colleges, you know, promoted too much pride and had other sorts of things involved in them that he didn't think were good, and so he starts Bible readings. But interestingly enough, Sommer soon discovers that Bible readings cause a lot of problems too, and that in point of fact, most of the things that Sommer would have criticized the Christian colleges for, the Bible schools for, were also problems at the Bible readings. So not long after they begin, he abandons them. There's a copy of the masthead of the Octographic Review. L.F. Biddle, by the way, had just died when this particular issue came out. And you can see his name on the masthead is in black, which is right there, or on this side, right there. The Octographic Review was an 8-page weekly newspaper or tabloid size. Very difficult, by the way, to try to preserve that kind of material when you're trying to do that and it comes to history. One of the things you find about Daniel Sommer is there's an awful lot of issues where he really is right. His enemies, you know, were not quick to admit that. Now, there are plenty of things Daniel Sommer was wrong about as well. And we're going to try to cover some of both of these. But I want to give an example of a couple of these things. There's Brother Biddle, shortly before he passed away. This is an ad for something called Vitaor, and this is actually the back page of the Gospel Advocate in 1909. And they advertised patent medicine. So one of the points of contention between Daniel Sommer and David Lipscomb was the Gospel Advocate is running all these patent medicines. And Brother Sommer's pounding away on him. He's saying these things are bogus. You know, you're ripping the people off. Well, let me share with you what you could use Vitaor for. You could use it for rheumatism and lumbago, kidney, bladder, or liver diseases, dropsy, stomach disorders, female ailments, functional heart trouble, catarrh of any part, nervous prostration, the grip, anemia, bloodlessness. I always thought bloodlessness meant you were dead, but anyway. Piles, sores, and other ulcers, constipation, and other bowel troubles, impure blood, and all worn-out, debilitated conditions. It will not cost you a single penny if Vitaor does not benefit. This is 1909. Now, interestingly enough, the religious journals, and not just journals connected with Churches of Christ, but journals connected with the Southern Baptist and others, had all been attacked by the secular press by 1909 over their use of secular advertising. And I'll give you an example. This is from Collier's Magazine of August the 3rd, 1907. And it's an article called The Great American Fraud. I should have a picture of the diagram because it basically shows a skull and a crossbones, and it kind of get your attention. But anyway, this is what Adams said. He says, there are thousands of quacks and fraudulent medicines, great and small. So there are hundreds of religions and sectarian publications of various scope and influence. He says, it's dry rot from which the journalism of churches is suffering. And he said, they serve God in their editorial pages. They serve mammon in their advertisements. And then Brother Adams goes on to say this, for some mysterious reason, the ethics of a certain class of religious editors exhibit a tendency to become lopsided. These gentlemen share in that extremely human error of berating the sins of others with such a vehemence they forget their own shortcomings. For example, the Gospel Advocate of Nashville, Tennessee, is quite sure that the country is approaching ruin through cigarettes, and it further opines the use of the organ in worship is a growing sin in our churches. I've heard some pretty bad organists myself, that if I edited the Gospel Advocate, I should clean up my pages a little before setting out to save my fellows from going to perdition via the music route. At the start, the editor might throw out his cancer cures, Vitaor, Mrs. Summers, known as the Bearded Lady of Notre Dame, Winslow's soothing syrup. By the way, I might add, a lot of these patent medicines had as their ingredients things like cocaine. So yeah, it soothed the baby, but it did other things as well. The Reverend Blosser and the quack Dr. Hathaway. Later he might continue the good work by casting out the various lesser chicaneries which dubiously decorate his paper, at the end of which house cleaning he could with better grace tackle the body-destroying cigarette and the soul-destroying pipe organ. Well, you can guess that Daniel Sommer said amen to all of that, right? So Sommer is at times denouncing David Lipscomb and others in very harsh language. And I'll share, we tried to pass out copies of a very fine book by Matt Morrison. If you're interested in Sommer, it's very, very well done. And what's striking to me about it is it was a book that was reviewed and endorsed by publications such as not only the Christian Standard, but also by Ira Y. Rice Jr. In his paper, because I think he does a really fine job of fairly setting Sommer's pluses and minuses before us. But here, this gives you an idea of Sommer's directness. To Sommer, the name Mormon meant, quote, monster and bugbear, and the Mormon doctrine he termed a monstrous affair. The common practice of monthly preaching, he said, only helps to keep life in a dead thing. And a man going to worship with a prayer book is like going courting with his grandfather's love letters. Sommer accused one critic of squinting at the Bible through a gimlet hole and then compared him to a contemptible varmint that killed chickens under the cover of darkness, and concluded by dismissing the correspondent as an unworthy opponent for debate. On other detractors, he hung epitaphs such as sneaking hypocrites, inconsiderate critics, and spiritual contortionists. Pretty direct, to put it mildly. And yet, a lot of the things he's being direct about, he's right about. But he's right in ways where he's not winning the argument. And I think one of the things that you learn from really looking at the life of Daniel Sommer is the goal for us as Christians is to teach people. If I'm not teaching someone, the fact that I'm right doesn't necessarily do me any good or them any good or anyone else. And part of the reason why I want to sort of focus our attention on Daniel Sommer at the age of 80 is he starts to make some changes in the way that he interacts with people. Now, one thing I want you to notice in this photograph, this is taken at a debate in 1916. Here's Daniel Sommer, and immediately to Sommer's left is his son, Daniel Austin. And I want you to remember the name Daniel Austin. This is Daniel Austin here. This is Daniel Sommer here. I want you to remember the name Daniel Austin because we're going to come back to that in a minute. Daniel Austin is the son of Daniel Sommer. One of the things that's striking, though, to me about this photograph is, to me, Daniel Austin looks like a little kid next to the old man. Now, there's interesting things about fathers and sons. The relationship that we have, and whether we're intimidated by our father or not intimidated, the Sommers were tough, tough people. And with Daniel Sommer traveling all the time, the boys were often in trouble. And most of the boys of Daniel Sommer would rather fight than eat. They were as mean as the dickens, I think quite fearful of their father when he was around, and yet the father was often not around. So that caused issues. Well, all right. Sommer, we've indicated, is totally opposed to Christian colleges. And a part of that total opposition, we indicated, is because he was worried about things like pride on the part of those connected with the schools and with ideas of that sort. But he also had ideas that were just completely wrong about the schools. And there were certain things that he believed about the schools that were false. And so one of the things that goes on in this battle between Sommer and those who were proponents of the school is sometimes things were being exaggerated and sometimes things were being shared that just flat out were not true. Sommer begins, though, to, as he grows older, to learn and to listen. Now, he's never going to be one of those soft, squishy kind of people. That's just not his personality. However, his tone starts to change, and he shares some interesting things. And he talks about this. He says, when I was a young man, he goes, and I would hold a protracted meeting. He says, I would preach the gospel plainly, and I would denounce error plainly, especially doctrinal error. And I would sometimes do such denouncing in the first or second discourse of a meeting. And as a result, I offended many of my audiences, and there were many people in them that were not prepared to receive what I said, and I drove many persons of those audiences away by my preaching. When told of this, I would say, but I told them the truth, and they couldn't endure it. They don't want to hear the truth. But I had not preached too long before I read John 16:12. I have many things to say to you, but you cannot bear them now. And then I thought that if Christ's disciples were not prepared to hear much that he intended to say to them, though he had taught them about 3 years, should I not withhold from my audiences what they were unprepared to hear? As a result, I began trying to prepare my audiences for any and all unwelcome truth that I wished to offer. And then I began building up churches. He said, you know, when I really started thinking about things, I realized that my approach wasn't right. And so the question becomes for Sommer, can I be direct and can I tell the truth, but can I do it in a way where I begin to teach people? And he seems to start to answer some of these questions in the 1930s. And there are several relationships that are involved. One relationship is with Dean F.D. Kirshner. Kirshner was the dean of the School of Religion at Butler University. Butler had been located in Irvington, which is kind of on the near east side of Indianapolis, had been located there until 1928. But in 1928, it moved up to right near the area where Daniel Sommer lived. And so he begins to have interactions with Dean Kirshner. Now, Dean Kirshner was connected with the Christian Church, not the most liberal wing of the Christian Church, but you wouldn't really say that he was very conservative either. And Kirshner wrote Sommer in 1930 on June the 5th. Now, Sommer's 80 years old. Now, one thing you have to know, if you're 80 years old in 1930, typically you're dead or you're an invalid. People just didn't live in good health past the age of 80 at the time. Again, none of the modern medicine, no penicillin, no antibiotics. Sommer in 1930 at 80 years of age is still in perfect health. There's nothing wrong with him physically at all. And so they begin to correspond, and Kirshner writes to Sommer, and he says, I've greatly appreciated your articles in the Apostolic Review. After Brother Biddle died, he got rid of the name Octographic Review, changed the name to Apostolic Review. He says, I've appreciated your articles, even when somewhat critical of my own position. I think your strictures upon higher education of the ministry deserve thoughtful consideration. I am therefore writing to invite you to discuss this subject at our Summer School Institute in early July of 1930. Sommer writes him back, and here's how he addresses the letter. My brother in hope. In response to your letter dated June 5th, I address you in hope. For whether your letter was intended as a friendly gesture or as a flag of truth, yet it suggests hope. And someone has said something about hope seeing a star. To this I add that the invitation you extend to me is specially appreciated because it is offered through the one to whom I have several times referred in the review and not always in a complimentary manner. And though compliance with your invitation will require of me a return to Indianapolis that I did not intend to make so soon, yet I shall, the Lord willing, make it for the time and purpose that you mention. In hope and prayer, signed, Daniel Sommer. So here he is in 1930 beginning to dialogue with people with whom I don't think he would have given the time of day. And with whom actually Sommer may have been as smart as F.D. Kirchner was, and intellectually, Sommer may easily have been his superior. But nevertheless, there's a conversation that starts to go on, and Sommer's starting to realize that, look, the goal ultimately is you want to be able to teach people. Well, that leads us to Peter Ainslie. We move from 1930, the year Sommer's 80, to 1931, the year Sommer is 81 years of age. Peter Ainslie was from the most liberal wing of the Restoration Movement. Some might argue so liberal there shouldn't have been a wing, but he was definitely from the as much of an opposite extreme as anyone could possibly be from Daniel Sommer. Ainslie was 17 years younger than Daniel Sommer. He had a worldwide reputation as an ecumenical and social justice leader. Now, they had some things in common. You know, Daniel Sommer, for example, he was a great believer in what we would, you know, call today civil rights, although the term didn't exist in Sommer's time. So some things were in common, but Ainslie held not one, not two, but three honorary degrees. You know, something that Sommer would have found abhorrent. And Ainslie held honorary degrees from Drake, Yale, and Bethany universities. And for 40 years, he was the minister for the Christian Temple in Baltimore, Maryland. His teaching primarily was Christian unity, world peace, and racial inclusiveness. Ainslie was also an advocate for open membership. Well, Sommer goes and he writes Ainslie and says, I want to come see you. Now, you know, you have to kind of wonder what in the world Peter Ainslie had to think about receiving a letter like this from Daniel Sommer, who, believe me, at 81 years of age, is still this incredibly formidable figure. But nevertheless, Ainslie says, great, now come on. And so on he comes. Well, there's great correspondence because Sommer has now built a friendship with Dean Kirchner at Butler. And so he writes home to Dean Kirchner. This letter is dated April the 24th, 1931. He says to Kirchner, my brother in hope, I've spent 2 days with Dr. Ainslie and I write you my estimate of him. He is as candid as I am, and on that account I like him. His wife is also candid, and they both deplore the spirit of division as shown by the Disciple Brotherhood generally, and I regret to say that they both underestimate the importance of the ordinances. This is a term of art with Sommer. Ordinances meant the Lord's Supper and immersion, baptism. And he said, frankly, though, he says, the reason that they do this is because of the divisive disposition shown by many disciples. What's the use of being baptized if we don't show the Spirit of Christ? This is what the Ainslies are arguing. And so he said, you know, I'm understanding what their thinking is. Do we agree at all? No. I mean, you know, Sommer's not given an inch on any of his beliefs, but he understands that if you're going to reach people, if you're going to teach people, the first thing you really have to know and understand is where are they coming from? What is their thinking? Ainslie, also a friend of Kirchner, is also writing Kirchner. And here's what Ainslie writes about Sommer. He said, Mrs. Ainslie and I have had for some days as our guest Brother Daniel Sommer, with whom we are both very much pleased. We have talked on almost every theme regarding the church and its work, and I have found Brother Sommer a man of piety, kindness, and understanding. It is remarkable to find a man 81 years old who has his mental alertness and kindly attitude. In fact, I would have thought him a man 20 years younger by talking with him. He preached for me last night, and our people were greatly pleased with his strong, scriptural, and practical message. Well, what an amazing thing, right? To think of Daniel Sommer in the pulpit of Peter Ainslie and conversing with him, and Sommer is doing his best to teach him. So even though they're very, very different, he's doing his best to do what he can. The Apostolic Review in 1932 featured the following front page article. So now we go to Daniel Sommer at age 82. And one of the things that's in this article, and there are a number of points that are made, But the heading, of course, can't we agree on something? He comes to Bible colleges and orphan homes, and although Sommer didn't write this article, the article was written by one of his sons, Chester Sommer. Daniel Sommer endorses it. And so what he says about Bible college and orphan homes is this: supporting them is an individual matter. The church contribution is not for that purpose. We're saved as individuals anyhow, not as churches. If anyone must take the risk, let that one do it as an individual. It's a matter of believing in the efficacy of the church. If a preacher or brother talks to us privately about Bible colleges, just inform him kindly yet firmly that you don't support them and tell him why. I can't force them not to believe in them, but maybe we can reason with them. So this is Chester Sommer writing. Now, that seems sort of innocuous in a way, but it creates an absolute firestorm in the followers of Daniel Sommer. They totally disagree with what Sommer's saying. To them, support for Christian colleges is a matter of salvation. Doesn't matter whether you want to believe them as an individual or not. They're not going to support them in any way, shape, or form. They're not going to permit them or the preachers from them to speak in their congregations. We now come to 1933. Sommer now is 83 years of age. And here's a great letter that Sommer writes, and this gives you some sense as to Sommer's handwriting and penmanship. Some of this is a little hard to read, but to share the highlights, Sommer writes to the folks down at David Lipscomb College and says, I'd like to come and talk to you. And so here's the letter that he writes home to Chester and Bessie and Allen, who were the publishers of the review, my young folks, his three children. Who'd have thunk it? Here I am in David Lipscomb's home, writing on official paper furnished me by the president of the college here. Suppose WGR knew this. WGR is a reference to a man named William Grant Roberts. W.G. Roberts was one of the leading debaters of the Sommerite movement. He loved to argue more than he loved to do almost anything else. W.G. Roberts' favorite debate proposition was resolved. Joseph Smith was a thief, a liar, and a polygamist. And Brother Roberts would debate that proposition at the drop of a hat, and if he didn't drop the hat, he would debate it anyway. He loved to argue. So he says, what would suppose WGR knew this. But he says, I'm doing what is necessary to let these people know who and what we are in the Brotherhood. I've spoken three times over the city, twice here at the college, with an invitation to speak here again tonight. Yesterday forenoon, I spoke here on education. This forenoon, I spoke on health and happiness, and tonight I'm privileged to choose what I may regard as best. Last night after my speech, one person said, if you talk much more here, we'll arrange to keep you here. That is on the faculty of David Lipscomb College. Well, what's happening? What happens when you start to converse with people and you begin to dialogue? One of the things that happens with Daniel Sommer is some of the harshest attacks that he'd made on the Christian colleges he realized weren't founded. So, for example, one of the things he had claimed was that David Lipscomb College and Freed Hardeman College had set themselves up as church colleges to avoid taxes. Well, what do you know about schools in Tennessee? They're all tax-free anyway, right? So one of the things that he discovers from being at David Lipscomb College is, no, they weren't a church school to avoid taxes. Any school in Tennessee was going to be tax-free. And so when he goes back home, in the review, he writes a correction and an apology. So he's learning and he's listening. And he begins to develop a much more open mindset towards the colleges. And this continues from 1933 all the way through 1939 when he suffers a debilitating stroke, his first real illness in life. And in 1939, he actually goes back. I can remember hearing Earl West talk about being a student, and lo and behold, who's speaking in chapel one day in 1939? Daniel Sommer. So Sommer begins to modify. He begins to dialogue. He begins to listen to others. But part of the trouble that Sommer has is that the Sommer movement itself is not very open to that kind of dialogue. And it doesn't really matter that Daniel Sommer's doing it. And one of the people that's most appalled by what's going on is his son, Daniel Austin Sommer. Daniel Austin doesn't have his father's physical presence. He's not a great speaker. Daniel Austin is a very good writer. One of the things that I brought, this was published in 1950, and found a cache of them that I was given and have passed out to folks that are here. Daniel Austin's guide, How to Read the Bible, which is very well done. It's a very good basic survey. And Daniel Austin would go around to churches and they would spend time on the Bible using that booklet as a guide. He was a very serious, sober-minded person. He's got the name Daniel. He's sort of the favorite of the parents. They're expecting him to be the great preacher in the family. And while the other boys were fighting and Daniel Austin could fight if pushed to it, it wasn't his disposition. One of his brothers said of Daniel Austin that they would go fishing. And the Daniel Austin would sit there with a book in one hand and the fishing pole in the other. So he's very, very studious. And not only is he very, very studious, but he's also very much imbibed the early spirit of his father. One of the things that I found of a parent, I have two grown daughters now, is there's a tendency for children to imitate our worst characteristics and avoid our noble qualities. And I certainly found that in regard to myself and my parents. Daniel Austin really picks up on this combativeness. These are some of the men who basically disfellowship Daniel Sommer. They won't have anything to do with them. Amongst the most prominent of them, you can see right here is Carl Ketcherside. This is E.M. Zur here, who wrote a commentary on the Bible that Carl Ketcherside published. These are a number of very, very prominent men that were all kind of lieutenants for Daniel Austin Sommer, and they're all severe personalities, at least in the 1930s. Now, we have to be kind of careful that we don't confuse the Carl Ketcherside of the 1930s with the Carl Ketcherside of the 1960s. But Daniel Austin is just incensed that his father would ever go to a college and send anything favorable about a Christian college can't possibly be right. And so he begins to attack his father, and he attacks his father publicly through the pages of his own publication, which was known as the Macedonian Call. And it becomes embarrassing. And yet, it is what it is. And one of the things that Austin tries to say about his father is, well, and some of us remember the history of Alexander Campbell, how he became the president of the American Christian Missionary Society late in life after having opposed them as a young man. And some people have written that the only reason that Campbell did that was because he would, you know, senility, dementia. I don't know whether there's any truth to the charge or not, but it was a current charge. And so part of what Daniel Austin says about his father is, well, you know, the old man's just losing it. You know, like Alexander Campbell, you know, he's just mentally not all there. Now, the reality is, Daniel Sommer was as much there as anyone, and he wrote his son and said, "Son," he said, "after this charge that I'm losing it or that I'm like Alexander Campbell," he said, "I would remind you that Alexander Campbell was your age when he became the president of the American Christian Missionary Society." Nevertheless, the son continues to attack the father, and I'll give a few examples of some of the things where Daniel Sommer tries to very kindly to reason with his son. He says, "My dear Austin, your treatment of me for the past few months especially has caused me to think of Absalom's treatment of his father. In your recent letter to the church in North Indianapolis," which is the church that the Sommers had been associated with and with which Chester Sommer was an elder, "your recent letter to the church in North Indianapolis has caused me to think of Psalms 50, verse 20. Thou sittest and speakest against thy brother, thy slanderest thine own mother's son." One of the things Austin was doing was he was bringing up the sins of both Chester and Allen Sommer, who were publishers of the Review, both of whom had fallen away for a time and then had come back. He said, "Yes, I am here reminded of Proverbs 20:20, whoso curseth his father or his mother, his lamp shall be put out in obscure darkness. You have certainly been trying to curse me during this last few years by your talk and writing against me as a decrepit old man whose work is about done." Another example, he says, your personalities concerning your brother will rebound against you in the estimation of all sensible and sensitive people who become acquainted with those personal attacks. Those brothers disgraced me, but only privately, while you have disgraced me publicly, and you've done your own family much harm besides, causing much grief. But I am the chief sufferer, except the cause of Christ suffers most. You know, you can't be a father and not be moved by what's going on. And yet, I think Daniel Sommer realizes the sincerity of his son, and yet he can't reason with him. He can't get through to him. And they end up being estranged until the day that he dies. This is a very fine photo of Sommer at the age of 80, taken in 1930. Near the end of his life, he writes for almost all of the major publications, again trying to reach out to folks. This is an article that appears in the Christian Leader, and the heading on it is The Wisdom of a Sage. So he lived long enough. All of his enemies were long dead, in a very real sense. And so there's a certain amount of reverence that comes with age if you can kind of hang in there long enough. Sommer, I mentioned earlier, basically enjoyed perfect health. There's a letter where he writes one of his children and says, I had a physical at age 76 and I was pronounced in perfect health. I had another one at age 83 and I was pronounced in perfect health. At 86, perfect health except for a little weakness in one ankle. He's 87 and he says, I'm going to be hunting bear in the Allegheny Mountains. And so he encourages his children that they would do well to think about taking care of themselves as well. Then this is a photo of Sommer at age 85, and if you see the handwriting on the bottom, that's in Daniel Sommer's own hand. And he has kind of a way with words. I mean, he addresses Kirshner as my brother in hope, and here the caption on his photograph is, Daniel Sommer's shadow at 85. At the age of 89 and a half, he has a stroke, and as a result of the stroke has blindness. He's able to take the train home to Indianapolis because he's traveled so incessantly, everyone on the train knows him. And so he gets home and lives just a few more months before he passes away in February of 1940. Every major publication of the Restoration Movement, from any extreme you want to pick, had a long obituary about Daniel Sommer. And I'll share just a couple of these and then we'll close. Sommer himself kind of writes what I think of his own obituary. This is July the 15th, 1939. He says, I don't understand all my ailment, but I suppose I'm liable to become unconscious at any time, and I've decided to make a few final statements concerning my life's work. I have nothing to regret concerning the course I've pursued as a preacher and writer, except that I've been so fearful of being uncharitable that I've strained charity in behalf of many who've not appreciated it. As a result of this condition of mine, I decided many years ago I did not have any real enemies, but friendly friends and unfriendly friends. My friendly friends were those who understood me and tried to help me in my work. My unfriendly friends were those who didn't understand me either because they couldn't or they wouldn't. F.D. Kirshner, his friend, wrote this, and this is in the Christian Evangelist. He said, notwithstanding his rather extreme theological views, Daniel Sommer was one of the most tolerant and fair-minded men we have ever known. He had the Christian attitude toward the search for truth and the Christian spirit in his method of dealing with people with whom he disagreed. He had no trace of that ecclesiastical bigotry which refuses to sit on the same platform or speak at the same meeting with another individual suspected of heretical views. Instead of this widely prevalent Phariseeism, the editor of the Apostolic Review would go anywhere he was invited to speak, no matter how much he disagreed with the people who were managing the program or the general point of view prevalent at the meeting. He rightly reasoned that unfavorable circumstances of this kind made it all the more incumbent upon him to deliver his message whenever he had a chance to do it. Hence, he preached the gospel everywhere to all sorts of people and under the most bizarre and unusual circumstances. Money was no consideration with him. Lots of other things I think we could say, and hopefully this maybe gives you a little bit of an idea about Sommer. Certainly, you know, his views on Christian colleges were extreme, but I think if you understand a little bit better where he was coming from, and I think he himself sees this in old age, it helps people recognize that some of the things he was critical about were things we should take note of. On the other hand, being careful to separate the wheat from the chaff. Appreciate everybody's attention.